This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon, this is Live and Learn. I'm Chua En Teck. Last month, Prime Minister Datuk Sri Najib Razak launched the Malaysian Indian Blueprint. Among the goals are to get more Indians into universities, the civil service, and double the income of poor Indian families. Here to tell me more about the blueprint is Dr. Denison Jayasuriya, Principal Research Fellow at the Institute of Ethnic Studies at UKM. Dr. Denison, welcome.
Yes. Thank you for the invitation.
So what were your initial thoughts on the blueprint?
I thought as a whole, when the Prime Minister in 2015 made a promise in Parliament when he was presenting the 11th Malaysia Plan, that in itself was quite significant because the development plans in the past have only singularly identified the Malay Bumiputra community as a specific target of affirmative action and intervention. But now to publicly declare in Parliament that another document would be coming out soon, consistent to what the Najib administration have been executing, largely in the post-2008-2009 leadership, is something significant. But the document in itself and the reading of the document and the launch of it has had an impact to me in both my responses to positive comments of it, but also some shortcomings or negative aspects or criticisms. But I think what is critical is, in the way forward, how would this be implemented in an effective, accountable, consultative manner, which is the next step. I think getting it on paper is one, but delivering it on grounds and monitoring and effective implementation is another. But it's a major breakthrough in public policy arena, and I can narrate that in due time, because I have been in this process since 1999 in the Mahathir administration when they had the second consultative economic council. I was then appointed as a member, and I was part of the Yayasan Strategic Social, and we presented so many papers at that event. Incrementally, there were items in the second outline perspective plan, in the 8th, the 9th, the 10th, the 11th, where there were references to the Indian community or addressing issues pertaining to displaced plantation workers or addressing issues of urban poverty, but not in the scale of a total document that is owned by the federal government being launched in this way. So it's a major breakthrough in public policy and in development planning as a whole.
But why is a blueprint like this needed? Has development failed in a way that necessitate a document like this?
That's a valid comment, because if you look at it, any development policy like the Malaysia plans or the budget is actually for all and every citizen. That means on a grounds that you are a citizen, you are entitled to health, education, protection, higher education, all the services that is provided. There are times when specific planning and targeting is necessary. And this was done in the new economic model for the Malay and Bumiputra community, because they were seen historically as disadvantaged. It comes from the constitutional provision of Article 153. And in Article 153, the emphasis is on the special position of the Malay and Bumiputra community, in that sense, the natives of Sabah and Sarawak as well. But the document also highlights, the constitution highlights, the legitimate interests. And so if we take on the 11th Malaysia plan, actually the phrases in the 10th plan alludes to it, but the 11th is strongest on inclusive development and a multidimensional nature of poverty and addressal. So within this context, specific targeting of marginalized communities, this then would be like the bottom 40%. So the 11th plan, in one sense, moved from ethnicity to class in its defining the target group. But in defining the target group, you then need to particularize who within the section. And one of the sections identified is the bottom 40% of the Indian community. It's not actually talking of all Indians in this predicament or in a position of historical disadvantage or some injustice. So it's the bottom 40% who are largely displaced. And so you need specific targeting. Actually, development planning has in the past addressed concerns of the rural poor, or they have addressed like fishing community, or they have addressed issues of the Orang Asli community, or of other specific communities in the urban and rural, or even taken a broader framework of gender disparity or gender inequality. And then you need to break it down in order to see whether it's reaching specific groups. So in this case, the blueprint of the Indian community is a logical follow-through of inclusive development. Should the government stop with only this particular blueprint? No. I think it should revisit the Orang Asli community, the poorer section, forest-based communities, Penans. You have like Suhakam reports that highlight on rights and development rights, socio-economic of Orang Asli community or the natives of Sabah and Sarawak. Actually, some of this was done in the Millennium Development Goals, disaggregated data to show who might not be in school. So you then need to quantify, you need to target it. So ethnicity, gender, class, geographical location can play a part. This is not saying development policy is becoming more racist, so just saying inclusive, everybody can. Because the theme is leaving no one behind is the UN Sustainable Development Goal agenda. So leaving no one behind, you then need to ask who is left behind. So ethnic indicators, religious indicators, gender indicators, geographical location, class indicators need to play a part. In this, the promise, of course, the accusation is that this is politically motivated, it's for elections. That's a different question. But for development planning, is it consistent with the 11th plan? I would argue yes. Is it consistent with the federal constitution? Yes, it's a legitimate interest. If a section of the community is disadvantaged, deprived, they should have measures that should target them. We're not saying have all special institutions, hostels, schools. We're not saying that. We're saying now, how do you target to ensure like women get into the workforce more? And within women, which sections of the women? Is it rural? Is it in Sabah, Sarawak? And in this case, this document is addressing sections of the Indian community. Of course, other Indian subgroups will feel disappointed because they are not the focus of attention. If you are in the bottom 40, if your incomes are below 3,000, if you are largely displaced from the plantation, then there's specific addressal for you. But if you're looking for listing your company in the stock exchange or something, this plan has nothing for you at that high top 20% or even middle 40%. It's targeting the bottom. And so there could be some misunderstandings because the title itself takes Indians as a collective term. But as one reads through the document, it's the bottom 40% of the Indian community. And they've said it's something like 250,000 households below a particular income level, using figures from the 11th Malaysia Plan or household survey figures that they are using, or unemployed or undocumented. So if you're undocumented, and here the figure being given is 25,000, as opposed to a figure that people have popularized, there are 300,000 people who are undocumented, who are Malaysians born here. So that is something that needs to be verified over exercise to identify. So where are these 250,000 households that are regarded as in the B40 category of the Indian community? And how would the delivery of the services and what the program is saying will lift them to a higher level of social mobility through education, healthcare, housing? How will that be done? Is a mammoth task. I think putting it on paper is one. The next to hand-holding process, identifying the leakages that can take place, or direct targeting, it might not go to the target group. It's not financial handouts, you know. There's no financial handouts in the scheme. It's actually competitive, merit-based. It is to support the communities, and this is what I would say about the blueprint.
My guest today is Dr. Denison Jayasuriya from the Institute of Ethnic Studies at UKM. We'll talk more about the blueprint after this break. BFM 89.9. You're listening to Live and Learn. I'm Chua Intik. Here with me is Dr. Denison Jayasuriya, Principal Research Fellow at the Institute of Ethnic Studies at UKM. Dr. Denison, the last economic master plan prepared by the MIC in 1974 was considered largely a failure because it was too vague. Is this blueprint better on the specifics?
Okay, I think I don't know how this reference to the 1974 blueprint of MIC came into the picture. Yes, I think the political party, think tank groups, academic institutions have consistently presented papers over periods of time. Yes, the MIC then, under Tan Sri Manickavasagam, and the main architect of that blueprint was Dato' Padmanabhan, who worked out. I think it was a fantastic report. I still have a copy of that report. But one needs to distinguish between political party writings and recommendations, because from 1999 right down to 2000, right down to the 11th Malaysia Plan submissions, I have been directly involved, either for the party or from UKM research team that we have presented. That is different from this exercise. And I think a lot of people have confused because of simplistic arguments that the media has presented or politicians have blabbered. So to me, they are worlds apart. This is a document prepared by the Prime Minister's office or Prime Minister's department, because as I noted in the document itself, I'm not a writer to the document, although I participated in a number of the discussions. And a number of the footnotes does make reference to the work of the Institute of Ethnic Studies in the process, but we're not writers of the document. Now, the document ownership is of the steering committee. The steering committee chair is actually the Deputy Director General Policy of the Economic Planning Unit, and it has representatives from all the major federal agencies, women, ICU, EPU, Treasury, all the major ministries that are part of a cabinet committee have endorsed this. Then they have a technical committee that includes people from private sector, academia, government, Prime Minister's office, Secretary of the Government's office, that worked out some technical work. I think there were consultants, but they are not named in the document. But there is a whole stack of, I think there are 34 people in the technical and steering committee, but whole stack of people acknowledged at the background who were consulted, politicians, largely politicians linked to the federal government, civil society organizations and representative, private sector people, and academicians from public universities. So with the word go, it is different from the earlier document. So I would say it's not an MIC document, because the ownership in copyright and published by is the Prime Minister's office. So that's very clear in the ownership of the document. I think what took place is the launch of the program and the media blurb gave a much more highlight as a political event and the personalities that were highlighted. And I think that is a regrettable thing, because that possibly caused the confusion to why then people are saying this is an MIC document, will it survive, this is just a sweetener, this is an April Fool's joke. All these things are mentioned. It's an extensively compiled document with over 162 pages. It's not just a fly-by-night piece of paper. It's well-researched. There are problems to the analysis and things like that. But it's sufficient to say that there are enough materials here to take the bottom 40% of the Indian community, and the bottom 40% largely will be Tamil Hindus who were from the plantations displaced in urban, high-rise flats and locations. If it is effectively executed over the next 5 years with strict monitoring, compliance, public audit, it might show a shift in the trend of addressal. But if it is used as a political gimmick, in what some people are highlighting, then it will just be another document. But it's no way close to the documents I worked on or what Dato Padmanabhan and others have worked on, because that is community document. This has the ownership of the government. And we need to hold, I would think, much more the federal government and the Prime Minister, because even the forward is by the Prime Minister. It's almost identical like the 11th Malaysia Plan. It doesn't have a forward from the MIC chairman or community or the party. As much as some individuals want to make a claim, they made a contribution. They played an effective role in facilitating. And the government, rightfully in the federal, because as a cabinet minister, the MIC representative on cabinet played a major role in the various discussions. And I think that's not wrong. He's from the community. He's of the federal government, of the cabinet. Was this written by the political party? It's not. Was it written by a group of civil society submitting to government? No. It's actually the Prime Minister taking ownership and saying, look, the federal government is going to deliver this. It's already started, but it's now got a framework of targets, of analysis, of figures. There might be problems with it, and it can be brightened up and sharpened and things like that. But it's a working document. I would feel it's a live document that needs to be updated. It should be, you know, scrutinized. We need to argue over the analysis, the data, the targets, and strengthen it. Rather than say, oh, because we failed before, this will fail as well, so throw it out. So it is interesting that the launch and the presentation of this document has raised so many negative views to it. And it's actually a disbelief by a section of our society that nothing will be done by this government. So government at the federal level needs to put in place a better engagement with society, better disclosure of data, facts, money, websites, engagement with people on the ground to really display there is a genuineness in the program. I'm not taking in good faith, you know. Taking it in the same spirit as the 11th plan, taking in faith that all these agency names, because they are named by individuals from all the different agencies, plus their designation. They are very senior. Either they are number two, number three at the ministry, playing the role in the preparation of this document. Unless this was, you know, actually done by somebody else and somebody just listed all these names, then these people need to come up and say, look, my name is wrongly quoted in. If not, the steering committee was chaired by none other than Dato' Nick Azman bin Nick Abdul Majid, who was chairman, is Deputy Director General Policy Economic Planning Unit. He's the most senior civil servant who has lent his name to the document. And then you got technical committees, people working, people writing up. So those are important things to note where this document is coming from. If not, people will think it's a political party tool that was written up, hodgepodge, and then presented. Because the only knowledge the public is having is largely the media coverage, which was quite good. But in-depth study, review, debate, agreement, disagreement has not taken place at the public arena.
You know, the skepticism or the disbelief of this section of the population that does not think the government is capable of doing anything good, I think their concern comes from the fact that maybe poverty is an issue that should be colorblind and a needs-based approach would be better. That was one criticism that's been put forth. And you also mentioned earlier that there are historical disadvantages to subsection of the Indian community. And you're from the Institute of Ethnic Studies. What are the advantages of looking at an issue like poverty through a racial lens?
Okay. I think it's important for us to distinguish that much of the development agenda based on sustainable development goals and the 11th Malaysia Plan is consistent with that, is a multidimensional approach. You cannot just take income and just focus on income. You need to look at health, education, housing, attitudes, mindset to enable and the historical injustices within that context. So it's multidimensional. It's rights-based. By doing that, it doesn't mean you become totally colorblind. What does that mean? You now need to target groups. You can't just say, I'm going to do this poverty eradication, you are poor, please come. The poor won't come. You have to actually now find the poor in that environment, and that poverty is then being retargeted on a number of different variables: ethnicity, race, gender, geographical location. So these variables need to be taken into account. If a particular group is singularly, regularly be focused, like media does it, it's stereotyping, it's stigmatization, Indian youth and gang and crime, you've raised it. You cannot run away from the fact that that identity of that particular ethnic group is featuring there. You now need to say, okay, we will help all boys, doesn't matter. You have to now target this group. And then ethnicity is one indicator in that. By doing that, it doesn't mean you will not allow others to participate. By recognizing race as a variable or religion as a variable, you are anthropologically understanding the target group that's needing help. So language might be an issue, your ability to communicate, your ability to relate to people becomes important. If not, you say, okay, this program is colorblind, is open to all. Specific target groups are not coming. That's where development planning fails. So you have to target, if it's orang asli, then you need to look at historical, cultural, their preferences, their priorities, how do you work with them. Let's say orang asli community. The Penan community might be similar. So by saying just go needs-based, it's not facing reality. And that's why people are now insisting, SDG is insisting, they want breakdowns. They want you to say, okay, how many people applied for this job? Why, if there is low representation in this job, why aren't other ethnic communities coming? What are the reasons? You know? So disaggregated data is necessary to identify the actual problem group or group that's needing assistance. If not, there is leakage. If you take Indians just in general, you will still have a leakage because there are socially mobile Indian groups that will take advantage and the disadvantaged and marginalized groups. So one needs to look at development from a rights-based objective, which is needs focus, but ethnicity, I would use ethnicity more than race here, is an identifiable group. If a complaint is coming that this section of people are not able to access, why? Are the programs designed? Is there a problem with food? Is there a problem with language? Is there a cultural practice? Who are the workers there? Are the civil servants or the NGOs operating sensitive to the culture? Because it's human relational development in this case. So in looking at it, okay, we are not being racist in saying specific targeting is needed. I, as a developmental sort of sociologist, would say, go ahead, get blueprints for other communities because your umbrella concept is inclusive development. And if you don't target, if you don't monitor, if you don't use ethnicity to monitor, if you don't use gender to monitor, if you don't use geographical location to monitor, you're going to miss pockets of people who are then what I would regard as, you know, modern sociology is describing them as the hidden poor. They are in the flats, they are unheard of, they are unseen, because you're not seeing 100,000 people who are starving in the city of KL. You're not seeing. You will see a single mother who is struggling with her children, her husband in prison, drug center, or is an alcoholic. They are struggling to pay their rent. So the ground realities. So is this a problem in the Indian bottom 40? How do you reach them? An ethnic approach has to be there. But that doesn't mean that service should isolate people of other ethnic communities. There might be Chinese, there might be people from Sabah and Sarawak, or there might be an Orang Asli, and so forth. So take ethnicity as a variable for identifying, not as a gatekeeper to block others. This is an important difference in the delivery. But you need to have disaggregated data. Data is lost. The whole data of the Bhumiputra community is saying everything Bhumiputra is like that. But if you break the Bhumiputra community to Malay, to Sabah Sarawak, to Orang Asli, Sabah Sarawak, you break from the majority groups, either Iban, Kadasan, to the sub-ethnic groups, you will see the poverty groups just coming out. So then you would say, oh, how much can we break down? But that's the reality. People are living in groups. They are living in religious communities. They are living in ethnic communities. You cannot run away from the fact in how people are living and where they are and where they are associated. And we need to target them so that they come out of it, you know, in that way. So it's a rights-based approach. It recognizes need. But recognizing need means you cannot just say, you know, I'm now colorblind, I won't look at color, I'll just... It's nonsensical. You need people who are sensitive to culture, language, religion, ability to communicate, ability to empathize. So if you are a Malay civil servant, then you need to understand the culture. You need to reach out. You need to be compassionate, you know. If you can't do that, if it's just a bureaucratic table and you are across the table and trying to, you will not empathize. The person won't come to your office. Likewise, if the officer is, let's say, an Indian officer and a Malay machi comes, and if he's unable to communicate in Malay, if he is not gentle with her, if he's not loving or caring, if he's not going to go out and carry the bag for her, and she feels comfortable, if she doesn't feel a sense of trust with the person, you cannot make a breakthrough in poverty or in any area of development work. So that sensitivity needs to come, that specific targeting needs to be in focus.
Are there any weaknesses or gaps in the blueprint you'd like to see addressed?
I think while I have affirmed the positive aspects, my own reading of the document and in a recent discussion I hosted among academicians who were involved in the contemporary Malaysian Indian document, I think maybe six areas could be noted in quickly to sum up. The first is, I think the title and the impression on the document given is as though it is all-encompassing magic book for the Indian community. And so everybody wants to see something in the document for themselves, whether it is sub-ethnic communities or the middle 40% or the top end. So there is some clarity that needs to be highlighted, that the document is really addressing the bottom 40%. And for all other Indians, they need to approach the normal services of government. If not, there is a danger of ghettoizing the community, because everything then goes through one channel rather than, you know, you are a citizen and you actually go through the normal process. So this process is trying to address the historical disadvantage. So the impression, and a lot of people are upset from the writings because they feel my sub-ethnic community is not highlighted. So what is there for me? Or I'm an entrepreneur, I want to publicly list my company, there's nothing here for me. But it's actually for the bottom 40%. That is the first area. Second, I think there is a weak link in the document, and this was highlighted in some of the preliminary meetings I attended, to the 11th Malaysia Plan. The linkage to the 11th Malaysia Plan is not strong enough. And that is a pity, because it is riding on the development agenda of the 11th, and there is a total absence of the Sustainable Development Goals framework, because Malaysia is going to launch the roadmap for SDGs, which is 2013, which is the global indicators and measurements addressing inequality, education. So the Indian community for the bottom could have actually become a global case study as a targeted group in the SDGs. And that's a missed opportunity, at least in the document, but in the delivery they can address it. That, I would think, is a second. Now, the third more serious comment raised, and actually some of the opposition have highlighted this, Kasturi, YB Kasturi raised that, gender doesn't seem to be a strong component, whereas poverty and inequality and the bottom 40%, gender is the heart of it. So culture, cultural oppression or disadvantage, the single mother, and those sort of things didn't feature out. And it's not a problem as yet. In the delivery, they can address it if they take cognizance of that drawback in that context. Now, the fourth point, which is more a serious technical errors, because there were people, academicians, who came for our discussion. They were checking footnotes, you know, to see the sources of data, page numbering of the source or the quote. And I think there have been a lot of errors on the bibliography referencing, the footnoting. Data might be dated and more contemporary data is available. They had not. So it didn't go through a rigorous academic review, which people are suggesting this is like a first draft document that was rushed through the press and out. But when you put to the test, I didn't check any footnote, but there was someone who went through most of the footnotes and has written a paper of the inaccuracies, and he cannot find the quote from the source that they have mentioned. That's a serious technical error, which can be rectified in due term. I think the final major weakness in the document, although the areas like the four principles, the four problem areas, the 17 specific interventions, I think very comprehensive. For the first time, such details have come up: unemployment in the Indian youth, or the recognition of the historical disadvantage and injustice has come out. But the weakness of the document is that the delivery and implementation is not well spelled out. And all of us know in Malaysia, we have got good blueprints and papers written, but the finer details is on the delivery, specific targeting, who would deliver it, what is the operational budget allocated. There isn't a corresponding budgetary other than the announcement of 500 billion or 1 billion and some things for Tamil school, these sort of things. There is no operational mechanism other than the structure. And the structure seems to be more a special unit of four units coming together, which is good. But the interrelationship with the key critical agencies is missing. The document is not spelling it out. So the ghettoizing of the community, which is now equal or full citizens, or people say we are third class or second class citizens, might further narrow down to anything you need, go to this department. They have to sort it out. Whereas that shouldn't be. The link to the various agencies that took ownership of it. So if it's a family-related problem, this special unit could monitor it, but the delivery is women and family development. If it's education, it's not special to the Indian community. It's the Ministry of Education that is delivering it. I think we went through a Permandu experience, which then has been replaced now. They have been decommissioned in that sense, or disbanded, to strengthening the ministry. So each ministry should then have inclusive units that are looking at where are the gaps in delivery to specific targeted groups: education, health, housing, governance, human rights violations, police, these sort of things. So the document doesn't bring this. It doesn't give an operating budget, how many staff. How are you going to deliver this mammoth task of 17 specific? I would personally think you need to write 17 operational guidelines to how you're going to identify the poor, how you're going to follow through, how you're going to ensure undocumented 25,000 people are going to be reached over the next few years. How many people are going to be involved? If you just say NGOs are going to do it and things like that, that's not effectively spelled out. But that doesn't mean it's lost. I think it's a promise of the federal government. It needs the next stage of an operational document. And I think most important, there needs to be far greater public disclosure of data, one, to public discussions. It's not questioning the government or distrusting. Distrust can only be dispensed if we have greater discussion and disclosure. Then people will know. They need to. Someone, actually it was YB Kulasegaran, who suggested that there should be a parliamentary select committee that looks at. So engagement with parliamentarians might be important. If not, half the Indian community who might have not supported this government is going to cry down this program. This program is a government program that needs to reach all. So social dialogue, public accountability, town hall meeting, greater disclosure is important to win the confidence and empower the community to monitor delivery. Find who are the people without IC's, BC's document. Who are the people below a certain income level? Where are the youths who are failing in school? It's a total community effort. It's not ghettoizing the community, but it's national because every national federal government agency needs to come in. This needs to be complemented, actually, and the document doesn't do that, with state governments and local authority addressing issues of housing, local governance, ground-level issues, the role of the police, the role of counseling, which is quite well highlighted. But the operating mechanisms is, in to me, the real nightmare. It's in the details. It's in the data analysis. It's in the compilation. It is in the monitoring. It is in the follow-through. Because government will be held accountable in 5 years' time when 2020 comes into being, when the 12th Malaysia Plan comes for review, when there is global voluntary reporting on the Sustainable Development Goals, then minorities, gender, forest-based communities, class issues are all central to global review. And this is going to be. So we have to get the data, the act together, because it's not just going to be a Malaysian concern. It's going to have some global effect. If Malaysia does it well, then it is commendable for the nation that a disadvantaged, marginalized group, minority, is able to. So you need the academicians to come in. You need the university people. You need the grassroots organizations. You need the business community. You need all the government agencies to support it and not resist it because, why should we do to Indian only? It's not just that. We need to do not just to the Indian, to every disadvantaged community, because the policy is we do not want anyone to be left behind.
Thank you so much for speaking to us about this. That was Dr. Dennison Jayasura, Institute of Ethnic Studies, UKM. You've been listening to Live and Learn, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.